What's my most favorite thing to do? To talk. Every week I'll do just that. We'll feature national and international movers and shakers, experts in their fields, and all around interesting people with something more than great to say. No holds barred. We'll tackle every topic imaginable, especially for women over 40. This is Conversations with Sima. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. Today we'll be talking with an activist, feminist, writer, and a lecturer about her life and the future life of this country. Rebecca Walker is an award-winning writer and lecturer, named by Time magazine as one of the most influential leaders of her generation. She is the author of the memoirs Black, White, and Jewish, and Baby Love, and the editor of the anthologies To Be Real, What Makes a Man, One Big Happy Family, and Black Cool. Her writing has appeared in Book Forum, Newsweek, Real Simple, Glamour, and a host of other publications and literary collections. Her latest book, Ade, A Love Story, is currently being adapted for film with Madonna set to direct. She lives in Los Angeles, California. So welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm happy to be here, too.
We're all happy to still be alive after that election.
I'm coming around to that, my friend. We're just starting slow. So in thinking about doing this segment with you, I want to share something personal. My father is an extremely well-known behavioral optometrist who fundamentally believes that how you see, what you live, and how your vision is provides you with the lens in which to interpret the world. So I'm wondering, as the daughter of an African-American woman and a Caucasian Jewish father, as how you term yourself an ambivalent mother, a feminist, a bisexual, what is your lens that you've been blessed with?
Well, I'm fascinated by your father, so because I've just now started actually wearing glasses. So before I answer that, does he mean literally your vision?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yep.
And so in terms of my lens on the world, being shaped by my family and the way I was raised and the many cultures that I moved through and participated in and languages I learned to speak, not necessarily just spoken languages, but physical languages and psycho-emotional languages, because every community seems to have their own. And I felt that because I was a part of so many, I learned so many. I think that the end result of all of that has been, first and foremost, a turn into being a student of Buddhism. You know, I started to read Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, when I was in high school, and then moved through many different areas of Buddhism, many different teachings over the years until really finding a spiritual home in Tibetan Buddhism, specifically Vajrayana Buddhism. And I think that really what works for me within the study of the philosophy and the ideas of Buddhism is a sense of openness, sound sense of being able to connect to people as fundamentally human beings who want to be happy, a sense of devoting one's life to understanding that and trying to support their wish to be happy in whatever way I can, and to somehow mesh that with cultivating my own sort of inner peace. I mean, this is sounding very New Agey, but, you know, for me, it's a very real practice to be able to have a kind of equanimity no matter what is happening, and to try to, instead of sort of devolve into panic and isolation, to be very discerning and compassionate, you know, as I try to navigate the world. And I guess, you know, the sort of down-to-earth, you know, or the, not down-to-earth, but the more secular view would be, I just fundamentally feel comfortable with just about any group of people and really identify as a citizen of the world, which is not to say that I think differences don't exist, but it is to say that I'm much more keen to appreciate differences, look for differences, celebrate differences, and also then find commonality. You know, it just seems to be hardwired into my system.
So that was going to be my second question. Actually, I was going to ask you, how do you feel about the role you might play in society? And you must look at society more like a community of yours, right? I mean, you must feel very grounded and integrated, correct?
Well, I think that's been a long project, because even though I have come to this space of feeling sort of whole and myself no matter where I am. I don't think that our culture is necessarily one that embraces me and my beliefs and my physiology, my color, my gender, all the different signifiers of my body. I don't think that that is a kind of, you know, the world is not quite where I am all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So while I carry a sense of comfort and ease, I think that I'm always negotiating resistance to my being, to my ease, my signifiers of race, class, gender, spiritual tradition. So, you know, it's a constant negotiation. But I would say, and I often tell my son this, you know, I'm not afraid of emotions. I'm not afraid of feelings. I'm not afraid of people's views. I think that there's a point at which I engage and try to create an openness that leads to conversation. And there are moments when I realize that that's not possible and that it's best to conserve one's energy. But fundamentally, I really try to walk with a sense of the possibility, at least, that we can find common ground, because I think that's the best idea to hold. I'm not naive in thinking that that won't be difficult. You know, we may need to be very active and insistent and persistent and acute in our response to people's desire to silence us or marginalize us, but I still believe that it's possible to reach a different outcome than the kind of balkanization and polarization that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I believe that not only because I think it's true, but because I think it's the best idea to hold. It's the best idea that will provide the outcome that we want. If we hold on to ideas that it's all futile and hopeless, not only do we make ourselves sick, but we can't possibly model anything better for our children.
Do you feel a personal sense of responsibility to either enlighten or educate, inspire Americans and our society at this point?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. At this point in my life, you know, I turned 47 yesterday.
And congratulations.
As a writer and speaker and teacher, I do feel that my vision for what my role and responsibilities are has shifted. I think that my first 7 books have all dealt with trying to make more space for people who have not had space and a voice in the popular discourse or in the culture. My first book on intergenerational feminism was all about creating a space for younger women to have important conversations with older women about the notions of empowerment. Black, White, and Jewish obviously was about trying to have a narrative of a multiracial identity at a time way before we had a multiracial president. My book about masculinity was about trying to create space for men to be fully present on the spectrum of humanity, not just expected to be stoics and workaholics and soldiers. You know, on and on, I think all of my work, I have felt a very strong sense that my experience can contribute something to supporting people who want a different world and who are looking for examples and models for how to do that. And I think really that's what my parents had in mind for me. You know, they, as I write about in Black, White, and Jewish, you know, they were in the civil rights movement, married when it was illegal to marry in Mississippi. And they had a real vision for me as somebody who, you know, they called me a movement child, that I would be able to function in the world in a way that was building bridges between people. And I think in my way, I have tried to do that through my work. At this stage, I'm really looking at what my role is. You know, I've been asked a lot to comment on the election, for instance, and many, many things, you know, by many journalists and newspapers that I've worked with before. And I don't feel the same kind of urgency. I think that there are a lot of younger people who have the kind of energy to do that now in a different kind of language that speaks to their world in a way. And it may be a time for me now, and this is really what I'm doing, to be a bit more reflective as I work on things that are not necessarily so topical, you know, that are not about addressing an issue, but that are more textured and about exploring a sort of psycho-emotional terrain. My last book, Ade, is autobiographical fiction, and it's based on the experience I had falling in love with a Muslim man off the coast of Kenya and accepting his marriage proposal and then getting caught in the middle of a civil war and having to be airlifted out of the country. And while that book is very much touching on important themes and ideas about openness and love and transgression and all of that, it's really at its heart a love story, you know, about two people and about how a relationship can change your life. So I'm moving more in that direction. And also, you know, I've moved from Maui recently to Los Angeles because several of my books are in the process, one way or another, of being adapted. And that's feeling very good to me, to feel like work that I put so much into is going to have, hopefully, another life, another kind of iteration that is very contemporary. And that's very satisfying. So I'm really in a period at this stage of reflecting on when and how I should enter and what is the most effective way to do so.
As the listener well knows, I've spent more than 8 years in the genre of midlife mothering, new older parenting, talking about renewal and reinvigoration in midlife. And I'm guessing that in your life, you said 47, these are the things that are impacting you. You are probably becoming more introspective, I'm guessing, by what you're saying. And I'm wondering, are you thinking about reinvention or renewal or reflection or even about the next 50 years of your life? Do you frame it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if the next 50, but definitely the next, you know, the next period. I think what I was just saying is a result of really taking stock and of recognizing that this is a different stage and that within this period my creative process is shifting, my sense of how best to use my energy is shifting, my sense of my role is shifting. You know, I'm putting a lot of time into parenting. I think that's a very interesting thing to think about. I find these days that I feel very strongly that one of the most important things I can do is give my son a very strong compass and a sense of support and the sort of direct transmission of some of the ideas that I've been trying to share with the world for so long, that often when you write and you're active out in the world, you sometimes think that your kids are just getting it by osmosis, but they're not. And so I've been really conscious of my work as a mother. And, of course, my changing body is fascinating to me. You know, I recently cut off all my hair and, I mean, not all of it, but, you know, a lot of it, and stopped dyeing it. So now I have some gray hair that's very apparent. And that's been a very interesting transition to kind of move. I think all of my work and my life has been about authenticity. And there was a certain point at which I started to feel that I just wanted to let go of the artifice of not being where I am. And that, just doing that has been frightening. Well, frightening's too strong. Has been curious, has been provocative, has been revealing. Mm-hmm. You know, I realized how much I had grown to depend on or rely upon a certain presentation, you know, and to see and learn to love and accept again myself and my body and my mind now has been an important journey of these last, I would say, few years.
In asking you further about this midlife mother phase, I'm wondering, what methods do you use for grounding yourself and staying centered other than your Buddhist practice?
As a mother or as just an everyday human being?
Yeah, I think both.
You know, I try to eat healthily.
Sure.
You know, I try to get as much sleep as possible. I think having partnership in my life is very important. I think that it's important to be loved and to be touched and to be really, you know, engaged in cultivating meaningful intimacy. I don't think I could survive. I mean, I would survive, but I don't think I could thrive without that. Let's see, what else do I do? I'm very much about cultivating beauty. I find a lot of healing in beauty, whether that's, I'm looking right now at this gorgeous fig tree that one of my students brought for me, and it's next to a very old Turkish rug that's amazing. The colors and the patterns are amazing. and the sun coming through. I mean, I think that beauty, specifically beauty that, you know, that I respond to, you know, it's hard, it's always subjective, but the beauty that speaks to me is very restorative, and I'm always looking to make sure that there's beauty in my home and in my life everywhere, and that's very stabilizing. And I think at this point, you know, really trying to let go of a sense that I have to do things the same way that I've always done them, you know.
I do know.
And, yeah, and being open to that and feeling a lot of gratitude that I have the grace for however long, maybe 3 more months, who knows, it could be 3 years, but however long I have to sort of be in this space of discovery, I feel very grateful for.
I think that's part of the bewilderment and wonderment of life, is that none of us know how long we have. And so I think as you age, that becomes more obvious. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding? We are very much, I think part of Buddhist practice is, you know, to constantly be thinking, you know, many people find this very sort of morbid, but it's actually very enlivening, you know, to always be thinking about one's death, mm-hmm. you know, because it could happen at any moment. And the point of thinking about that is to really wake up and be alive.
Yes.
You know, because you cannot take any of it for granted. And knowing that the end of this realm is going to come helps me to really try to find joy in every moment, no matter what's happening. So yes, at this age, I guess I'm a little more in touch with it, but I think it's been something I've been thinking about for a long time, mm-hmm. 20 years or so.
I don't really want to talk about the results of the election, but what I'd like to talk about is what's going on as a result of the election. Your thoughts, please, on the issue of racial divide in this country. Where do we sit regarding feminism and the push for gender equality?
Well, you know, I think I share the thoughts of many, many, many people. I think this is a very shocking, it's a very sad, I feel that for many of us it's a very, there's a lot of sorrow, there's a feeling of loss, there's a feeling of uncertainty, anxiety. I think that we will need to be open, we will need to be vigilant, we will need to really keep our wits about us. I can't say, you know, anything about the state of anything, really, at this point, in terms of feminism and whatnot and race. You know, I think that we've just elected, or, you know, 50, however many millions of people have just elected someone who does not seem to prioritize peace and really is invested in, for whatever reason, manipulating people's emotions and really evoking a kind of latent rage and anger in them that I think comes mostly from sorrow. And so it's a very, very challenging time. I think we're going to see a lot of rolling back of things that are very dear to many of us.
Mm-hmm. But he did it well. I mean, he did it very, very skillfully.
He did. And, I mean, the thing about Trump is that he came to win, in a way. I mean, I think he's shocked that he won. You know, I was reading a piece. You know, politics, it's war. It's a civil war. It's not a conversation. And so he came daggers out, all is fair in love and war. And I think, you know, the Democrats, we pride ourselves on a kind of humanism, I think, or we try, or at least that's the presentation, and not wanting to be at war. But there's a naivete around, as someone said, going to a gunfight with a butter knife, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to have to understand the different terrains a little better. But, you know, as I've told my son, I think it's not the time to be reactive. I think it's the time to be calm as possible, and to think strategically, and to use our energy wisely. You know, I've looked at everything from leaving the country mm-hmm. to this movement to have the Electoral College vote according to the popular vote, to really pressuring or asking the Obama administration to during this upcoming recess to put his Supreme Court nominee in, which is legally possible for him to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want every young person who's full of passion and enthusiasm to go to law school. I think we have to be very focused on holding up these changes that he believes he can make for as long as possible, using whatever means we can, the way that the Republicans have held up so much in the last 8 years. But I think what's concerning me the most today is what appears to be, and I think many of us knew this to be true, but it's shocking, is just the deep ineptitude of the operation in actually moving into position.
Yep.
I think the lack of preparation, the lack of understanding, you know, about the very basic demands and requirements of this position, this is, I think, my greatest concern,
mm-hmm.
that because of the Senate-controlled House and that the checks and balances, you know, are going to be few and far between, and that really chaos will reign, not just domestically but internationally. So, you know, that's a kind of discerning point of view, and there's also an openness that perhaps, you know, we can find a way to transform this moment into something beneficial, but it's going to take a lot of our best selves coming to the table, you know, our brain power, our heart power, and our refusal to give up. You know, I think another thing that I've talked to my son about is that, you know, all of the people that are being identified as problems in the country now, people of color, immigrants, Jews, women, gay people, I mean, all of it, you know, we have all been here before. I think that this is a very frightening moment for many of us, but the history of America is bloody, and the people who have survived have kept their wits about them, as I keep saying. They have not succumbed, and they have used their very best minds to forward the community. And so that's what I expect and what I hope for in our communities. You know?
Before we move to the final segment, why do you think we've lost our way?
I think it's very hard to judge, you know, whether we've lost our way. I mean, I think we don't know what the outcome of this will be. I think it may be energizing. It may clarify some things for people that were not clear before. It may pave the way for a different outcome that may be better for our children. It's very hard to say. I think that's part of how we can remain open. I mean, I think we've all been working very hard and done our best here. I think we could make some simple statements about underestimating, you know, the simmering rage and backlash, underestimating the needs of working class Americans, all of that. We could go there. We could talk about NAFTA. We could talk about welfare reform, quote unquote. We could talk about so many things on the surface. But I think fundamentally it's not as helpful as really having a sense of not knowing at the moment what all of this is going to mean and trying simply to show up at the appropriate moments with actions and words that can be helpful. And we need to be practicing that now.
Mm-hmm. So just a couple more questions. What do you hope your legacy will be? Other than your son, what would you like to say that the future would hold, and therefore this would have been the stamp you made on people around you or our society?
It's interesting. I think about this sometimes. Obviously, there are two parts to this. There's a part of me that is not very invested in the notion of posterity or of what I leave or of legacy, but because it's just not the way I think. But at the same time, I do know that I want to die a good death. And for me, that means I want to feel that I have done the work that I'm supposed to do while I'm here. And so that work includes using my own experiences to try to create more safe spaces and more understanding and more a greater sense of community and wholeness in places where there hasn't been that kind of language and communion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's very important to me, you know, I've been thinking about this right now, you know, it's very important to me that my son knows that he is loved and is prepared to face this culture. I hope that when I am remembered, and it's very important for me that my students, you know, I have some very close students that I've worked with, that they are able to carry on some of what I've given to them and what others have given to me, you know, which is a commitment to supporting and cultivating all that is deeply human in everyone that they touch, you know, and deeply committed to a certain level of sanity, accountability, compassion, presence, sort of waking up into adulthood and stewardship and understanding that you cannot just remain a child in this world. You have to take your place and figure out what that is and how you can be of service. And I think, you know, if my students, you know, my close-in 3 to 5 students and then all of the other students that I've taught, the dozens, hundreds now, you know, if they take some little bit of that, I will feel good. You know, I will feel that I have done it. You know, I think I've made some good strides in that department. I feel good about the work I've done. It's taken a lot of energy, but it is the work that gives me peace at the end, you know?
Yes, I do. We've been talking today with award-winning author Rebecca Walker about her thoughts, feelings, and desires for both herself and our country. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being my guest
today. Oh, you're
so
welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure and opportunity to think about a lot of these things this morning, so thank you.
Rebecca can be found at RebeccaWalker.com. I'm Sema Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Thank you so much to the listener for joining us. And until next time, I hope you take care.